Good morning, Jacksonville. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Dan Scanlon coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. And we've got an exciting show for you today, so let's get to it. Today, we delve into the throes of domestic violence with advocates from the Hubbard House. Then we take a look inside Jacksonville's historical casket factory. And what you need to know about the No Trespassing Graffiti and Street Art Show that's coming up this Friday. But first, you may or may not know, it's October and that's National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. That's a time when victims, advocates, allied professionals, abuse survivors, and their families can come together to remember the lives lost to domestic violence and to celebrate the progress that's been achieved in ending the epidemic. They also get a chance to connect with those working to bring about change. And with us is Hubbard House, a well-known local and well-known, longtime local safe harbor for women and men in Jacksonville and across the country who need help and their children who come along too. So if you or someone you love are experiencing domestic violence, call them 904-354-3114. Now, joining me today, Stephanie Brown, Community Education Manager at Hubbard House. Hey, Steph.
Good morning.
We go back a long time. Just got to meet Tammy Taylor. She's the Chief Program Officer at Hubbard House for the past 19 years. Morning, Tammy.
Good morning.
And you can join the conversation, too. Call us at 549-2937. Tweet us at FCC On Air. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Or message us at First Coast Connect on the Facebook page. The first question I've got, and guys, I've been covering the kickoff news conference and the bad statistics about domestic violence homicides that was held this Tuesday for probably many of the 26 years that report's come out, and I've got it right here. But I probably never asked the dumb question here. Give me in 30 seconds here, the history of Hubbard House. Who started it? Why? When?
Hubbard House is amazing because we were founded right here in Jacksonville. There was a group of women who saw a need for a domestic violence hotline to serve the area. They started that, and one of the volunteers was actually riding a bicycle down Hubbard Street, which is in the Springfield area. They saw a house up for sale, and that's how Hubbard House came to be.
Literally.
Literally.
A Hubbard Street house.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the amazing thing is, at that time, we were the first dedicated domestic violence shelter in Florida. And among the first in the country. So it's really a source of pride that we were on that forefront of serving and supporting victims of domestic violence.
And let's not forget, guys, that these days you have Micah's Place, you have the Betty Griffin House, you have, help me here, what's the other
Whitley.
One?
Whitley House.
Whitley House. And that's Nassau, St. John's, and Clay County. So you have places to call. You have places that help. You have hotlines that are 24/7 at all of these operations. And if you want to find out more about that, my story in Jacksonville today from Tuesday has a lot more information and the events. Now, the really tough question, because everyone has a different idea. What is domestic violence?
Well, domestic violence is any when someone is wanting to have control over someone else. Also, physical violence could take place in that relationship. Emotional, financial abuse, sexual abuse. So just one person having control over someone else.
So it doesn't have to be physical, as we heard from the survivor, Melissa, 2 days ago at the news conference, where things were thrown at her, where she was choked and gouged and otherwise abused. It can be silence. It can be belittling. It can be manipulation.
Absolutely.
It's important that we think about the physical violence first and foremost, because that is where things will become deadly. That is where the extreme danger to a person's safety lies. But safety is not just physical. It is emotional safety, financial safety, psychological safety. So that's where we look at those other tactics. I think the other thing that's important to know as it relates to physical violence is some relationships may see near ongoing violence. Some may see one explosive incident and no other direct violence, but the threat of violence hangs over that relationship. There's no clear pattern or understanding of what this has to look like. We tell the survivors, what is your gut telling you? If you feel unsafe in any capacity, then we're here to help you.
Absolutely.
And you know, the one thing I've heard through all of your news conferences, all of these victims or sisters of victims, such as you had a year or two ago, is outwardly you never see anything. And the victim sometimes thinks they can become the fixer. As Melissa said this week, you think you can fix it and you cover up, and on the outside, no one notices. Stunned me that she said, this survivor this week, that she went to a different doctor every time she got injured so that no one would ask her about repeat injuries. And when she might be, I guess, showing some signs of trying to get out, the husband, now ex-husband, would tell her, no one's going to believe you. You're covering up too well. So it literally becomes this brittle soap opera.
Think about the manipulation that right. takes place. So in the example you cited, her personality was to want to be that support for people. And that's something the abuser hones in on and sees and exploits. So especially if the abuser is in a position of public influence or power, they're telling the survivor, you are not going to be believed if you come forward. Nobody's going to accept that what you're saying is true because they know me, because I'm this amazing person. And moreover, they're also convincing the survivor the abuse is their yeah. fault. You know, if you are that fixer personality, then the abuser is saying, well, if you could do better, the abuse would stop. If you had my meal on the table when I got home from work, if you didn't bring people over to the house unannounced, small things, big things. So now the survivor starts to internalize it. And are you really going to want to turn to a friend, a family, a loved one to get help if you feel like it's a personal failure of your own? So that's why it's important survivors know that that is manipulation.
I almost see an iron fist in a velvet glove that on the outside it looks pretty. Not if you're inside and it's being squeezed. Now, we've got an email question here. What is the progress on red flag laws that take firearms away from people who have threatened domestic partners? And then I'll have a follow-up question based on the statistics this week. But is there a red flag law in Florida that allows a weapon to be taken away from someone who's threatened?
So we know in Florida there's been great advancement with risk protection orders. And so that's something that allows police to assess whether to remove access to a firearm, even if there aren't necessarily specific arrests or charges that would require that. And it's important that we look at things like that because we know the presence of firearms is something that greatly enhances that lethality risk.
And as we're meeting with survivors, we're doing that lethality assessment to find out if firearms or other weapons are in the home so that we can help safety plan with them.
You know, the state attorney's office for 26 years working with you and police and other agencies has come up with an annual report on this. And the report for 2022, since we're talking about firearms, says that of all of the domestic violence homicides in 2022 that they covered, and again, that was 14 cases, 19 deaths, same as the year before, which is scary when you think about it. Gunshots, 10, 72%. Strangulation, 2 incidents, 14%. Blunt force, 2, 14%. All domestic violence homicide cases that were studied from 1997 through 2022, 59% or 187 were gunshots, 7%, 21 were strangulation, 28 were blunt force, 9%. Stabbing, 65 of those, 20%. And others, 5%. Does this mirror, does the Jacksonville area mirror nationally? Or are we worse, better, on par, what?
With domestic violence, firearms do increase the lethality risk. That is true for not, I would say, not even nationally, but globally. You know, as Tammy just mentioned, we do lethality assessments, and the presence of a firearm is one of the first questions we ask. For that exact reason. So it is something that we always want survivors to be considerate of. If there is a firearm in the home, we need to safety plan around that.
Hey, I tell you to call us at 549-2937, but unfortunately our phones are down. So make sure that you give us a yell at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect, WJCT.org, Facebook. We want to hear from you about this. Now, the next question I've got are, and again, I've heard this, but I'll let the experts here talk about this. What are the warning signs? What should we, just as friends of someone, look for that could be a sign that domestic violence is happening, whether it's male or female? And incidentally, intimate partner homicide gender dynamics, the female kills the male 36% of the in those 2022 cases. The male predominantly is the bad person here, 7%. Or 64%. So it's usually the male, But what are the red flags if I'm just hanging out, having dinner, lunch with a coworker? What should I look for?
Some of the red flags, isolation, checking in, unhealthy. We all check in with one another in relationships, no matter what the relationship is. But having to be on a time frame, checking in everywhere I go, getting permission to go to places. And usually abusers will isolate you from your friends and family that you usually have relationships with. Other signs to look for is wearing clothing that they usually hadn't worn before to hide bruises. As you talked about, the survivor who spoke this week, going to different doctors to cover up and hide those injuries that they're having.
Melissa said, and again, something that's just cropping up here, she said, he'd hit me in the head because the wounds wouldn't show.
Correct.
Again, that's an eerie, evil, canny thinking mode that you do it where no one's going to see it.
Absolutely. Over jealousy. There's just red flags that in the relationship, when we see as friends or a loved one, their behavior starts to change. It's okay to ask some questions, but to not ask those questions in a way that is blaming them for what's taking place.
And social media, I guess, is an indicator as well. If suddenly your friend somewhat disappears or something visibly changes on Facebook or Twitter, right?
I think that really addresses the bottom line of if you see any of these changes, right? You know your friend, you know your loved one, you know your colleague. Are there suddenly things that used to take place that aren't anymore? Or those changes, they used to post everything, now they're not posting. Or the opposite, you see so many posts about how great their relationship is. When I'm working with offices, for example, we'll talk about an attendance policy. Because what if you have that amazing worker, and then all of a sudden they just start being late all the time? Well, maybe their work habits changed and they just can't manage their time. Or maybe they're now in a relationship where that person prevents them from getting the car to get to work or hides their keys.
Because they don't want them to escape.
Exactly. And not just escape, because maybe it's just going to work, right? But they see economic independence as how that survivor can ultimately in the long term get out. So anytime you see those changes from patterns, from routines, just from the person you know, then as Tammy mentioned, ask the questions. It's hard, right? Yes. We worry how our friend, our family, our colleague is going to react if we ask them about their safety. But as scary as that conversation is, you need to realize that you may be one of very few people who see those warning signs, who identify those warning signs. And that means you may be one of few people in a position to offer what could be truly life-saving support.
Absolutely. And then if you're not sure what questions to ask, they can call our hotline, 904-354-3114, and our advocates can help family members and friends know what to ask.
That is a question I want to ask. What happens if I call you and say, my significant other is doing this and this and this to me? What's your first response? Do you invite them in to consult? Do you offer guidance, offer suggestion? I mean, what is that intake policy? Because having never seen where the facility is, obviously top secret, I don't know what happens. I've heard, and you can bring the kids with you, and there's a safe place there, but what happens?
When someone calls a hotline and they're ready to leave the abuse, then we're going to assess with them over the phone. We're going to talk with them. First, we're going to assess if they're safe to talk with us over the phone. We are an empowerment-based program, so whatever that survivor is in need of, if they're wanting shelter, we're going to help them get shelter. If they're wanting outreach services, we'll help them go through our outreach program to get assistance. And that assistance can be, again, shelter for them. All of our services are free. We'll provide counseling, individual counseling, group counseling. We provide services for the children. They have children. And then they're going to connect with an advocate that they will work with during their time in shelter or their time in outreach.
And interestingly, Melissa, I know when she, again, this is the victim who spoke on Tuesday at the news conference. Hers is in the past, a number of years, but she said eventually, somehow, after getting assaulted, the police were called. Police showed up and took her to the facility. What's the police officer's role, since the sheriff was distinct in stating that every one of his officers is trained in how to handle this? Do they bring, do they suggest, do they follow the victim to make sure they get there all right? And then at what point do they ever work with Hubbard House to determine prosecution or arrest?
So the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office is an important partner of ours because we are not in those immediate crisis scenes. They are. So we actually do cross training. We work very closely together. And one of the things that the officers will do on the scene is a very simple risk assessment, looking for things like, do you feel safe? Has your partner threatened you?
And they keep the victim away from the significant other so that the answers are hopefully truthful.
Correct. Or at least that it's a safer environment for the victim to be able to speak. And so then they do consult with the victim. If the victim wants to come into shelter, if the victim does not, and then we do have that relationship where we can support the victims that they're bringing in because they have identified that need. That victim has made that courageous ask for help in that moment of crisis. So we are absolutely going to make sure that we're supporting them in those moments. And there's a lot of ways that we also proactively partner with police. You know, we talked earlier about the number of lethalities locally. Well, a team from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, the City of Jacksonville, and Hubbard House sit down together every single weekday. And we look at the domestic violence related police reports that were filed the previous day and assess those for which have a high chance to escalate to lethal violence. And in those cases, we proactively reach out to offer support to that survivor. So the Sheriff's Office is not only a response partner, but also helping us make those proactive connections to try to reduce lethal violence in our community.
Guys out there listening, our phone lines are a little wonky right now, but we'd love to have some comments from you. So tweet us at FCC On Air or First Coast Connect, WJCT.org, or Facebook. Give us some questions. I've got a personal question. I will not say when this happened or where, but I was on a street, and there was an open garage one night, and I'm hearing a lady yelling at somebody and throwing things. And my first thought is, she is throwing something at her significant other. My second thought was, what should I do? That's my question. If I see something that in someone's house, the window's open, I'm hearing something happen, or in this case, the garage is open, what do I do?
Well, one of the things that we say, if you see something, say something. If you don't feel safe, assess the situation first for safety and your own personal safety. And you can contact the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office to come out because you have witnessed something that may be unsafe and you're not sure.
Yeah, I backed into the shadows and observed for about a minute and things seemed to calm down. So I went on doing what I was doing, walking the dog, legitimate. But it was just bizarre, you know. It's not the time of year for windows open. The garage was open and whatever. And of course, that was just before the news conference. So my mind was thinking about that as well. Now, what about the LGBTQ community? I mean, we are seeing obviously more couples together, and they're going to have domestic issues like anybody else. Any difference? Any? Are you seeing more now that those couples are married and that there's long-term relationships going on?
So domestic violence happens regardless of background, race, age, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity, education, right? Hubbard House supports all survivors. And it is important to also know we use the name and pronouns that survivor identifies. We don't require your birth certificate, your education, any kind of documentation, because there are unique tactics to the LGBTQ plus community. So, for example, an abusive partner may threaten to out their partner. Maybe that person isn't out at work or with their family. You know, so an abuser can maintain control by saying, if you don't comply, I'm going to out you. They will intentionally misgender their partner. They will mock their gender identity. There are unique vulnerabilities there. And so we want any survivor, and especially LGBTQ+, to know that we support them, who they are, and their safety.
Because obviously sometimes their families may be the ones that give them the most grief.
Absolutely.
I don't care. I'm confused sometimes, but I don't care. You're the person that you are, and that's who I value. Is there an increase? Are you seeing more from that community? Horrible to say that. Are you seeing more people who are coming out, who are now part of our world, who we're aware of and we accept, hopefully, showing up because their relationships are now legit? They're married. They've got the license, and they are in a relationship that they thought they were comfortable in.
So, with the information that we look at, we're seeing an across-the-board increase.
Okay.
We served more than 4,800 survivors and children last year, which is an increase over the year prior and over the year prior. So we don't specifically look for what is your relationship dynamic. We look for the safety, right? So we don't necessarily highlight what kind of a relationship it is. It would be more just kind of what we see, what we experience. But out of that, really, again, it's across the board. There are more people right here in our community who need help. And that's why that 24/7 hotline can't be said enough. The 904-354-3114, because it is 24/7, free and confidential.
All right. That begs the question, like any nonprofit out there, if your business is booming, unfortunately, who's paying the bills?
About half our funding every year comes from a combination of city, state, and federal grants, but about half of our funding every year comes from our community. Yes. We are grateful to have served this community for nearly 50 years, and we are not afraid to say that we continue to need that support, because there are more people who need services. Those are the friends, the family, the neighbors of the people who may be listening right now. There are so many wonderful ways to support Hubbard House. We have a lot of information on our website at hubbardhouse.org. You know, it costs, we like to say, about $60 to provide one night in shelter to one person. And we provided more than 36,000 nights of shelter last year. So any way that a person wants to donate, volunteer, invite us to speak and raise awareness, those are all such amazing forms of support.
And obviously you have your annual fundraising breakfast. Tell me more about that, because that obviously is a place where you can come, sit, hear, listen, learn, have breakfast, and maybe leave a little something behind.
Yeah, so our 29th annual Barbara Ann Campbell Memorial Breakfast is taking place next Wednesday, which is October 11th. We do have tickets that are still available, and more information about that is, again, on our website at hubbardhouse.org. But Dan, as you mentioned, it's such a powerful program, because not only do we hear from survivor speakers about how they found safety, but we come together as a community to commit to working on this mission, to seeing that future where every relationship is violence-free. So an important part of that program does include honoring the lives lost in our community. We actually set a memorial table at the breakfast that shares the story of each of the fatalities in our area, those local victims of intimate partner violence. We know it's important to honor those stories, and then we commit to no more. We commit to trying to reduce that lethality in our community, and we come together to show that support for survivors, for Hubbard House, and for a safer future.
And one of 2022's victims was a pregnant woman. There was a baby in utero along with her and someone else, I believe, and her two children were in the house or even witnessed. And I've covered those. You, when you were a reporter, covered those. There's part of you that wants to get out of that crime scene and never say another word about it. as quickly as you can. But then there's other parts that says you want to follow this up and find out who gets caught. And maybe there's some education. I've covered many, many crimes in my day, and you'll usually hear the cops at the scene say drug or alcohol involved. Are those fueling these fires? Substance?
So abuse is a choice, and we can't say that enough. Mental health considerations, alcohol considerations, they may lower an abuser's inhibition, but they do not cause abuse. You think of all of the people who may have too many drinks at a bar on a given night. How many of them are harming their partners, right? It's not just the alcohol, the drugs, the things like that, that are causing the abuse. At the core, the abuser wants to control and manipulate their partner. And they may blame drugs. They may blame a lot. Something we'll hear a lot is anger management, as an example. You know, I have anger management problems. You can't hold me accountable, right? If a survivor we're working with says that their partner's telling them that, then one of the things I'll ask is he angry toward everyone?
Right.
Or is he angry toward you? Because if he's managing that anger around everyone else, then it's a choice.
Absolutely.
So, Tammy, the question that begs is a proposal or an assignment of the abuser to anger management or drug or alcohol treatment part of the process here? Can it help? Or is your job to get the abused victim away from the abuser and then work on something? Are there any steps?
What I would say to that is, just as Stephanie just said, it is trying to have control of someone else. Going to anger management classes may help you identify some things that you have going on as an abuser. That doesn't mean that they're not going to still want control in that relationship. So what we're working on is working on the survivor and helping the survivor to identify what their needs are, whether they are safe in that relationship. And if their safety is compromised in that relationship, then we're working with that survivor.
We are a survivor-centered organization. There are some other organizations in Jacksonville that will work with abusers, either to help them comply with court rulings about anger management or substance use, to do a batterer's intervention program. You know, that's up to other agencies to handle. Our focus is how can we help you, the survivor, be safe?
What I hear time and time again at these news conferences from these victims is they go back again. They come to you, they get out, they go back again. Do they think they can fix the problem? As I heard from Melissa, she told me afterwards that she, I guess she thought she was a fixer again on this. And what can you do? Or how do you tell them, don't go back unless this, and this occur?
We don't tell them that.
Right.
Right.
So there are so many reasons that a survivor may feel like their safest and best decision is to go back to that home where the abuser also lives.
It's part of their, maybe a part of their safety plan.
Right. You know, it's hard for us to understand outside of abuse, but it may be safer for them to stay in that home than to look at their other options. But that's where it comes to us to say, we can still help you plan for safety. You don't have to leave in order to access our services.
Right.
We want you to be safe, whatever your decision is. And it's important survivors know we don't judge if they go back.
Absolutely.
We don't judge if they need to come into shelter again. You know, we are here to support their decision-making and keep safety front of mind.
You know, Tammy, another thing I heard this week was Melissa stated that her husband had witnessed a lot of domestic violence as a child, and that seemed to be what caused him to do this. Are you hearing a lot of that from victims that the person abusing them, they come from a family of abusers, or they saw this, or they have tales from their younger age?
And we work with survivors who have said that, and witnessing abuse as a child or a child survivor is not an indication that a person is going to abuse. Has it happened? I believe yes. I would say yes. However, it's not. It still is does not give anyone the right to harm and hurt their partner.
Do they ever come out and say, he says his daddy did this, so I'm doing it, it's okay? Or my mommy did this, it's okay?
Generational trauma is
absolutely
something that we see. You know, if you're a survivor and your mom is telling you, well, you know, that's how I dealt with it, so why are you making a big deal, right? It's hard to be able to then step out and say, it may be what my mom experienced, it may be what my sister's experiencing, but it doesn't have to be that way. It is absolutely something that, you know, we look at safety for the survivor, but we also look at social change. So that's where opportunities like this are so important, because that survivor who's listening and thinking to themselves, I don't have support from my family. Right. I just hear that they've experienced it and I should just deal with it. We want them to hear in this moment, you don't have to deal with it.
And what about the children who witness this? Again, we heard that one of those cases last year, two children witnessed deaths. I'm sure there's some triage that's done by Hubbard House. But how do you help that child grow out of what they witnessed, that trauma, and not continue it?
Well, we do have our children's services, in our outreach, center. We provide individual and group counseling for children, for them to understand, one, that the abuse wasn't their fault, to understand those dynamics of abuse and work through those feelings and emotions that they have relating to what they have witnessed. Also, for, as Stephanie said just a little bit earlier, if a survivor is not ready to leave that relationship or it's safer for them to stay in that relationship right now, they can work with an advocate on how to safely plan to escape that relationship and to come out of that relationship. So they can be working with an advocate in outreach or in shelter or on our hotline each day to devise a plan. And again, the children can also work with an advocate and also with our children's counselor to help them.
And when it comes to our outreach center, because we've talked, you know, several times about our hotline, which, again, is an amazing resource because it's free, it's confidential, it's 24/7. But maybe you can't safely use your phone. Our outreach center is located on Beach Boulevard at the intersection of Dean. So it's 6629 Beach Boulevard. They are open every single weekday for walk-in hours between 10 a.m. and 2 p.m. So if that survivor can't safely use a phone to call for help, then we can still be there to support them if they want to come to our outreach center and meet with us there.
And all of the shelters in the multi-county region, I noticed on their websites, have an opt-out button. You can tap the button, website disappears, so no one looking over your shoulder sees it. We've got 30 seconds left here. Say the number again. How do you get help?
904-354-3114. Free, confidential. We are here for survivors.
That's Hubbard House. And this is Domestic Violence Survivor Month. Do what you can. We're just getting started, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back. A tisket, a tasket. Let's talk about a casket. Calling all goblins and ghouls, spooky season is officially here, and we're kicking it off with a closer look at Jacksonville's century-old casket factory and the fact that it's going to become something different soon. Dr. Alan Bliss, Chief Executive Officer at the Jacksonville Historical Society, is here to, if you'll pardon the pun, unearth the details. First of all, those of you who aren't familiar, the Historical Society has the Old St. Andrew's Church, it has the historic house next door, and it has the Old St. Luke's Hospital, and it's the building next to St. Luke's Hospital, which was, honest to goodness, a casket factory, so that you could one-stop shop, get your casket, and then just down the street, go to the Old City Cemetery. So, first of all, I've known about you, Gingerbread Extravaganza, every year as a fundraiser. What is the purpose of the Historical Society, Doctor?
Well, Dan, thanks for having us here, and always great. The Jacksonville Historical Society exists to strengthen citizenship in Jacksonville by educating its people about their past, collecting, preserving, sharing the stories about this city. And my argument is that Jacksonville has more and more interesting history than any other place in Florida. I say that with all due respect to your listeners in St. Augustine to the south and Fernandina to the north. Yes, they are old cities. St. Augustine claims its foundational moment from 1565. But Jacksonville, in its 201 years of existence now, has been fabulously crowded with interesting people, interesting and consequential events, things that really transcend just the city, that affect the state, that really affect the region. Stories about Jacksonville's history really are reflections of American history more broadly. And the Historical Society exists to help people understand the identity of this place. You know, with a place as it is with a person, the identity really springs from your life experience, from where you come from, your foundational and influential events, the people that have shaped you. It's the same way with people in cities and neighborhoods. And so that's the value of the past. That's why we exist. We strengthen citizenship of people by making them better acquainted and connected with the place that they live. When people know something about the place where they live and work, then they become more psychically invested, intellectually, financially invested. They care more about it in its present moment. They care about it in its future. They make better citizens.
You know, if you want to have a little fun, take one of the Evergreen Cemetery tours and find out who's there and the history that's there, or go to the Norman Studios, or go to the Mandarin Community, Mandarin Historical Society, and go to the Civil War era farm that's there. There's so much out there that I've learned in my 40 years here. Plus the fact that they didn't teach us back in New York when I was a kid. This is where America started. The French colony was at Fort Caroline, although some dispute it. Somewhat before the Spanish were in St. Augustine. So realistically, Europeans lived here in the Jacksonville area. Now, there's a lot of projects you're working on, but let's talk about that casket factory. I know there's been Halloween events there over the years, but tomorrow you embark on something interesting with that brick building next to the old St. Luke's.
Yeah, that's right. The Florida Casket Company building was built in 1920 by that company. They moved over to that facility after new building it from a facility they had operated out of over on Myrtle Street. And in 1920, Florida was growing, the population was growing, and as inevitably happens, the funeral and mortuary business was growing. And the Florida Casket Company was prospering. They needed a facility, so they built a three-story, 13,500-square-foot building. And on the first floor, they fabricated caskets. On the second floor, they finished them off with luxury fabrics and hardware and coatings. And they stored them on the third floor, awaiting shipment to morticians and funeral directors all over the American Southeast. They did that until 1966. The building has been in a variety of really sort of storage uses and auxiliary uses ever since then. And to walk into it now, it's really like walking into sort of a time machine. It exudes the authenticity of the moment in 1920. The third floor has been changed practically not at all since the building was built over 100 years ago. We are renovating it into museum and exhibition space on the first floor, a performance and event venue on the second floor, and expanded archives on the third floor.
Because your archives right now are at the old St. Luke's, which used to be Charlie Bennett's office, if memory serves.
It did indeed. You're dating yourself.
Yes, I am.
Here, Dan. Careful with that. But Yeah, Congressman, the late Congressman Charlie Bennett had his office in what's now our research library. My office is across the hall from that. Our archives are literally bursting at the seams. We have accumulated a great deal in the way of manuscripts, documents, photos. We have a photo collection of over 100,000 images, all pertinent to Jacksonville. So much that we have had to get into the offsite storage rental business, and accessibility is always a challenge, and making space available for researchers to work with our collections is a challenge. So we're re-identifying this whole campus, the Old St. Luke's Hospital and the Florida Casket Company building, as what we are now calling the Jacksonville History Center. And that's reflective of the fact that there are peer cities of ours in Florida, Tampa, Orlando, and Miami, to name three, that have very significant history centers that do far more with those cities' public history than Jacksonville does with its own.
And obviously, within a few blocks of there, you have the St. Andrews Church, which you use for a lot of events, including the Gingerbread House Extravaganza, which is, golly, 20-plus years in the making. And then, what's the name of the classic house on the corner?
The museum house on the corner is the James Merrill Museum House, named for the head of what was at that time Jacksonville's largest industrial employer, Merrill Shipbuilding, which occupied space on the North Bank downtown and employed thousands of people during World War I and World War II doing shipbuilding.
Now, to get back to the casket factory, isn't there a little rock and roll history coming in there, too?
Yeah, so one of the principal exhibits and one of the focuses of our initial exhibit planning is Jacksonville's music history, not just rock, not just blues, not just jazz, not just classical, not just you name it, not just those things. This city, like almost every city, has an amazing musical history. It's complicated, it's diverse, and it never fails to surprise people to discover how many stories there are wrapped up in music. And it is musical composers, it's performing artists, it's road managers, it's tour operators, it's concert promoters, it's record store operators. The beat goes on, if you'll forgive me, but these are stories that we have been working hard at collecting over the past 2.5, nearly 3 years now. We have an oral history collection of interviews that now exceeds 100. We have been gathering artifacts, illustrations, posters, memorabilia, and documents, and all of it will help strengthen this exhibit.
To find out more, go where, donate where?
JaxHistory.org. That's JaxHistory.org.
Yes or no? Is Casket Factory haunted?
Not to the best of my knowledge.
All right. Alan Bliss, Historical Society of Jacksonville. I'm Dan Scanlon. You're listening to First Coast Connect. Don't touch that dial. We will be back right after this.
Feeding Northeast Florida is working to put holiday dinners on the tables of families facing hunger this holiday season. Information on ways to help at feedingnefl.org. Congaree & Penn, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpenn.com.
JME presents post-punk band Dead live in Jacksonville. With their latest album, Blue Skies, the three-piece Chicago band combines reverb-heavy guitars, infectious melodies, and punk rock energy. Dead plays Jackrabbits on Friday, October 13th. Tickets and more information at jacksmusic.org/events.
I'm I'm Robin Young. In the 1980s, women were still considered less morally developed than men because they made caring decisions. Carol Gilligan said no, they just had a different voice. Now she says it's a voice everyone can have.
When caring gets gendered feminine, that's a problem. And my new book says no, this is a human voice.
Icon, Carol Gilligan, next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Is the Supreme Court poised to overturn a powerful legal doctrine despised by conservatives? The case in question would impact everything from how the government addresses climate change to immigration. So what should all of us know about Chevron deference? And why are 50 House Democrats calling on Justice Clarence Thomas to recuse himself from the case? That's next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Hey, the No Trespassing Graffiti and Street Art Show presented by the Petite Pop-Up Gallery is coming up this Friday. Candace Nicole, founder and curator of the Petite Art Pop-Up, is here with the details. Okay, I'm well aware of the major program in the city to try to put murals and do street art at intersections. Certainly we see it on the Arlington Expressway. We see it next to the Cancer Center. But we're talking something else here. So tell the dummy me what you're doing.
Awesome. So, we are having a graffiti and street art show. So this is like our celebration of street artistry. I would say that street artists are probably some of the most passionate group of artists because they're doing it straight from the heart and a lot of times not with public recognition. And so we just want to celebrate them, celebrate their art. And so we'll have live graffiti. There'll be other elements of their art in the gallery, and it's just going to be a great time.
I'm a New York City kid, and I always thought, minority thought here, that that what they did to the subway cars was a lot better looking than what the MTA had out there. The art was amazing, and obviously that mural that's on the side of the old movie theater at the Old Town and Country Shopping Center, I know, having done a story or two on that.
I'm on that mural.
That maybe I even talked to you. Those are amazing artists that do that, and I can't wait for them to finish that darn shopping center so we can get access to looking at it again. So how did you get the idea of doing this pop-up show on Friday?
So the Petite in particular, all of the themes are based off of nostalgia, happiness, and things that we enjoy because I feel like those are themes that we don't get to see as often because we're often talking about the problems that we have in the world. And so this is just another topic that I think is just great because it's something that we all see and then they're not often recognized. And so to me, this is something that we all enjoy and we just haven't seen it in gallery style. So,
your work is anime accented, isn't it?
Oh, my. No, you're, I personally don't have any work myself,
all right.
But the O that's on that mural.
That on that mural,
about,
yeah.
That's me.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, the
See,
blue lady.
I think I interviewed you
Possibly.
While it was being done, and another artist was up on a lift, doing his work.
Could have been my husband. He did one of those murals, too.
Okay, see, I am aware of these things. So the theme of this event is no trespassing graffiti,
yes.
And it's in big letters, no trespassing. I even see it on the flyers.
Yes.
So what can you expect? First of all, when and where?
Okay, so we are on Friday from 6:30 to 9:30, and we're right next to Sweet Peace. And so my project is a placemaking project where we're using an unused space and turning it into something beautiful. And so we'll have a gallery in the back. We'll have three live artists, and then we activate the entire space. So there'll be a DJ, lots of dancing. We hope many street artists or street dancers show up. And then we have a collaboration with Sweet Peace where we have our VIP. You can get the no trespassing candy bars and also cocktails. And then we have a super VIP upstairs that overlooks the whole event.
And that City Hall, James Weldon Johnson Park,
yes,
that
right
area, in case you don't know where that is, and the federal courthouse.
Yes.
So you got the feds right there. I know what I think of as graffiti. I certainly have upgraded those opinions now with Banksy and obviously the work that has been done around the city. But what can we expect when we hang out there on Friday?
What can you expect? So you can expect actually a lot of artists that who are kind of anonymous in a way. So they'll be present and they'll be showcasing work that is not the typical art that we see. So we're used to seeing their artwork on the streets, but they'll have canvases. We have quite a few interesting things, a table. There'll be lots of art that they represent themselves with that's not their walls that we're used to seeing.
Now, do you need tickets? Does this cost, or will it cost if you get into the Sweet Pete's in the VIP part?
Okay, so we do have tickets, but it is free. But we do have some VIP options like that Sweet Pete's and then our upstairs graffiti room. And so, yes, it's free to the public, but you do have some options. We also have our T-shirts available, and all of those things can be found on our link that's on our Instagram, The Petite Jax.
And again, the event space is the free place to wander into after work, and it starts at
6:30.
So you could go to Sweet Pete's and get some dessert, or you can find some eatery in the neck of the woods in the elbow there, enjoy yourself, and then wander over and look. And is it PG rated? I mean, we think of graffiti can sometimes get a little off the wall. Is it PG, PG 13 rated? What's if parents bring kids?
It is absolutely fine to bring children. My children have come to every show. So yes, please bring your children, let them experience the art. They see it out in the streets. Now they get to see it a little bit up close and personal.
And you've been here before, but what about the Black Mural Map? Where and what is that?
So the Black Mural Map is an initiative that I started actually right before the pandemic. And it was just a way to showcase Black artists, Black artistry, and representation. And so the Black Mural Map just maps out murals either done by Black artists or just of that representation. And so it's really the city. It's everywhere.
Okay, that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Executive producer, David Luckin. Producer, Stacey Bennett. Associate producer, Kathy Waterman. Our director, the Spielberg of the entire operation, Other Side of the Glass, Brady Corum. In fact, everybody, Other Side of the Glass. Thanks, guys. I'm Dan Scanlon. We'll catch you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.